sound.
C. K.
U.
T. T. 90.3 FM.
Territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgments are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. First things first, beyond our wildest expectations, this podcast now averages 4,000 listens per episode. Listener, you are wonderful. It is encouraging to know how many people like you care about gender justice and are doing what they can do to move from now what to now this. From the bottom of my heart, thank you for listening, subscribing, and sharing this podcast. Now on to our topic today. In Canada, women are more likely to live in low-income households than men, especially single mothers. Indigenous women, racialized women, and women with disabilities and trans people also face a high risk of poverty. That's why the Canadian Women's Foundation cares about building economic options and stability for women, girls, and gender diverse people. Economic stability and the improved quality of life it creates is the ultimate goal of our investment readiness program. It equips women and two-spirit trans non-binary people to succeed in social entrepreneurship and innovation. What is social entrepreneurship, you ask? It's something women, equity-seeking people, and feminist organizations do every single day. When they launch their own business ventures, many of them think, how can I generate revenue and help my community at the same time? How can I do business while making the world a better place? They are most ambitious about doing business that does good. And it's an ambition worth investing in. The fact that these entrepreneurs face disproportionate barriers to starting businesses and getting financing means we miss out on the economic benefits of their success and on the positive social, cultural, and environmental impact they could create to help us all. This is a missed opportunity all around. And right now, in 2023, we really need these wins. In the daily news cycle of rising costs and inequities, investees of our investment readiness program are a bright spot. Manira Abukar joins us to represent one such investee. Stitch Lab TO is a social enterprise of Scadencourt Community Center and an innovator in sustainable style. Through Stitch Lab, Manira works with local women designers to create their own one-of-a-kind products. Stitch Lab offers women skill development opportunities, and their products are made from repurposed and rescued fabric.
I currently work at Scadencourt as the project coordinator for social enterprises. My passion project actually at Scadencourt was the Sewing Hub, which kind of has blossomed into the Stitch Lab and a lot of other smaller projects. Fun fact about myself, I'm one of 9 kids. My parents fled the Civil War in Somalia and ended up here in Canada. I was born here and raised with 7 sisters and 1 brother. So I think I really shaped my lens in terms of how I view women empowerment and like the limitless things that we can do as women. I had a very strong mother figure. And so I think for me, it's really a lot of what I saw and experienced growing up really led me to where I am today. The year that just passed, I turned 30. And I think for me, kind of looking back, I think for my mom, it was really, she really fought to make sure that we felt seen and heard. A lot of times there's intergenerational kind of gaps that get lost in translation in terms of like what you think a life worth living is for and what your parents think a life worth living is for. And sometimes your parents don't see the vision, but I think my mom particularly did a really good job, for me at least. Sometimes I think we even butt heads about ourselves, where I became really independent and really strong-minded, and what I wanted, for me, was the most important. But also making sure that, you know, my siblings felt seen and heard, that we were as a collective, that we uplifted each other when we were going through dark times. And, you know, I think being obviously, you know, a Black Muslim woman, you're going to experience a lot of, you know, narratives in institutions where you feel like you don't belong, you feel like you're being pushed around, you feel like, you know, you're scared to kind of voice what you really feel. And I think from a young age, I was really told, just say what you feel, just say what you feel, do how you feel, and really just, you know, go in there, you know, representing yourself to the best of your abilities. And so it wasn't always easy. I think saying that sometimes is like, yeah, like, let's like do this. It's kind of like, it's not always easy, especially when, you know, you feel like there's a power imbalance in that space, or you feel like you're young, you don't know what the outcome's going to be. Is it going to impact my job? Is it going to impact, you know, my life? So it's not always as easy said as it is done. But I think, you know, for her, especially with the experience that she had in Canada and really integrating, and it was really hard for her, I think, But she did the thing. You know, she was like parent counsel for three schools. She really pushed for like the schools to change like their policies on halal meals. I think the biggest story I have my mom was like being in elementary school and seeing her say, "Oh, you guys don't serve halal pizza to the kids?" And they're like, "No, not really. It's not really something we've ever done before." She's like, "But like 40 to 50% of your school is Muslim. That's like, that's enough. We're going to call some partners. We're going to call some contacts. I know the community." And I think it's been now like 20 years since, but they still, that school still keeps that contact and still serves all halal because of one thing my mom said.
The anniversary of my mother's birthday happened this month, and I've been reflecting on the gift she gave me while she was here with us. Thank you so much for sharing your mom's influence in your life. It is so wonderful to hear about. So tell me how you got into Stitch Lab in the first place. What's it all about?
Well, what was funny for me was initially I wanted to go into law, but I found like sometimes there's a narrative that us immigrant children like won't say where it's like going into these professions could be like burnout in some ways. It's like you're already fighting a system from a very young age, and then you kind of have to do that now professionally for like your career. And so for me, it really was like an identity crisis where I was like, do I want to be doing this for the next like 20, 30 years? Like I already feel like fought out in some ways. I want to be able to channel the energy towards something that I can see blossom into like something beautiful, you know, not necessarily being in a courthouse every day having to, you know, fight another fight that I don't want to have to necessarily. Many, many moons ago, when I was going to university for my undergrad, I ended up applying on a whim for a scholarship there, investing in diversity scholarship. And this was in 2010 when I was 18 at that point. And I ended up winning that year. So it was really interesting because I was like, oh, this is like really, I didn't think they would bet on me. This is really exciting. I'm going to use this to pay for my undergrad. And then my younger sister, who was 2 years younger than I was, ended up winning. And then the 1 year younger than her ended up winning. And then it ended up being like six of us received a scholarship from Scouting Court. At some point, they asked me to come in and do like just workshops on like how to apply for scholarships and how to be like your most authentic self. And so even though it wasn't like geographically close to me, because there was such a lack of resources where I was, I felt like I really gravitated towards that center. Like I had a really good community there, really cool staff that reflected you. People were just very chill. I went from winning a scholarship there, you know, in 2010 to in 2017, 2018, you know, being offered a job there because they were looking to start a program with the City of Toronto based on sewing. Because I think fashion being one of the biggest polluters in our industry, one of the fastest polluting industries in general, you know, for our environment. Really looking at ways to say, like, how do we solve this crisis? And so we kind of helped the city create a program model where we would teach like free sewing hub classes, like sewing repair classes for both beginners and advanced folks for 8 weeks. And then we also had these like drop-in sessions where folks could come in and use the machines, different activities, like just different workshops in the community. And I think what I kept noticing was like a lot of the folks who were signing up for these classes, a lot of the folks who were using that space were women of color. And the city, I think, had some ideas of like, hey, maybe it should be like, we should take this in the direction of an enterprise. But I don't think they foresaw the fact that the enterprise would be like, let's take this a step further and say, how do we take these women who have the skill set, who have had these degrees, have had these like certifications and you know, accreditations back home, but it gets lost in translation here. How do we take that and rebuild that? Growing up in like low-income housing, growing up in the city of Toronto, services are so easily like come and go. Like you'll get so attached to a service, you'll get so attached to like a program that you're doing that you really enjoy just hanging out with your friends. And then the funding's gone and then everybody who was there is also gone. And so for these ladies, it was like, if we're gonna get them in, I don't want to be telling them, hey, you're just going to be sewing for minimum wage and that's it. And maybe it works out for a year or two or it doesn't, because this is something they love to do. And it's like that also creates a lot of trust. Like to be able to have them in that space, to have them be able to trust you is also a lot of hard work. And I don't think folks realize that for community programming. I want more for these women. I want them to have a livable wage. I want them to feel empowered. I want them to feel they could ask for anything and that, you know, whether it's like the sky or the earth, we provide that for them because it's something that, you know, they deserve. To come from somewhere back home where you're somebody and be told here like you're invisible is you want to be able to create a space where people are A, seen and heard, because that was what was created for me. So it really was like we had a lot of focus groups with them. You know, we really wrestled with whether this was a collective or an employment-based social enterprise. It was like I wanted them to influence the process from start to finish. And so when we were having these talks, it was during an interesting time because it was like right before COVID hit. So it was really challenging. I think they wanted to kind of put the program on hold. And so what was really exciting about CWF was like they kind of bet on us because they were like, you know what? Like, no, like we're like, we'll teach them from home. I will hand deliver machines, which I did. We set all of them back in my car and like a rental and just like drove off. Was it always easy? No. Older woman, they've never used Zoom before. I could hear the kids in the background saying, Mom, you gotta learn how to use Zoom. And their mom saying, well, yeah, come sit, teach me the Zoom. So I was like, it definitely was easy for them, but it was like, they never like made an issue. They're like, you know what? If you're going to bet on us, we're going to bet on you right back. Like we'll do Zoom classes. We'll do things online. We'll learn. No one gives them enough credit. I feel like the first objective obviously is like, how do we create products and how do we create a brand that really focuses and centers around sustainability? But also, like, how do we honor the actual true history of sustainability? I think sustainability isn't just Greta Thunberg. It's not these like young white women who are these Gen Zs who are really pushing for that. It's like, you know, I was taking Tupperware containers and upcycling containers when everybody was roasting me at school at my young age. Upcycling, downcycling, sidecycling. Mom's like, it doesn't fit you, give it to your sister. So at some points, like, we were already finding ways in our own communities. Like, we always had a good relationship with the environment. We always honored and really upheld what it was to really like have a full, I think, circular relationship with where you live. Hey, there was a story about green before there was this green movement, right? I think especially for folks of color. Yeah, let's create a brand that does that and honors that.
Let's pause here. Manera's wisdom resonates with me. Sustainability, environmentalism, and a good relationship with the land and earth is very much a part of many of our communities. As she says it, upcycling, downcycling, sidecycling, indigenous communities, newcomer communities, racialized communities have been doing it all. And they have powerful models to learn from. And I know lots of you know what it's like to be tricked by an ice cream container in the fridge that's full of soup or stew or sauce.
Also, it's like, let's create a brand that empowers women, where they feel comfortable creating their own products, creating their own things. Upcycled prayer mats, why not? It's really fun because they influence a lot of the collections. A lot of the things that we sell are actually things that they want to do. They handpick their own fabrics. Fabric is donated from partners across the city, just private partners, folks who are out of business and no longer need that fabric, 100% sustainable and diverted fabrics. So even if they want to outgrow the Social Lab and say, I want to become my own designer, how do I support that? Guys, like, the limit for them, like, there's no limit for what they can do at this point.
We'll bet on you if you bet on us. I love that way of framing community initiatives. So tell me more about why this women-led social enterprise approach is just so important to you.
Changing the status quo is a really difficult thing because it's so ingrained into our regular lives and our daily lives that we don't even realize that we're practicing things that could be harmful to the idea of community, right? If these are the individuals who are making your products, if these are the individuals who are having a direct impact, shouldn't their voice be at the forefront? Shouldn't what they're saying matter the most? And it's like, yeah, we can get funding all we want. We can have funders support us. We could have, you know, the City of Toronto, the CWF. We can have all these funders come in and see that. But it's like, they're betting on us because of these women. You know, not in spite of, but because of. And so I think it's important to say, like, this is who matters. This is who the project is about. Yeah, we're putting it in, you know, on an application that we have a democratic process and this is a collective, but are we actually honoring that day to day? You know, in that weird 2021, 2022 mark, you know, where things still were kind of unsure, a lot of them pushed and said, we actually want to come back in person. We actually want to be in person together. We want to be able to talk. And so for me, it was like, I'm not going to knock down that idea and knock down that space. I'm just going to find ways to make it possible. To give you a bit of context, we ran the programs out of a 40-foot retrofitted container. It's really tiny. And so what we actually ended up doing was we converted that into an office kind of sewing studio, but we actually took our laundry room and retrofitted that partially to have tables and stuff. We're still working on it. It's still a work in progress to have tables and spaces where they can actually sew a little bit social distanced. And for me, it's really great because you see a lot of women actually going out for lunch together. You see a lot of them like having events and inviting each other to their own personal events. So it's like you created essentially a sisterhood. It's like you created an actual community that's there for them. They're able to call each other when things go wrong. You know, they have their own group chat on WhatsApp. They talk to each other all the time. And so it's like, I'm glad I listened because if I didn't, they wouldn't have created this cohesive group for themselves.
So your story is so inspiring. I bet people will get ideas. What advice would you give to those starting out in social entrepreneurship?
Andrew, if I had to give a piece of advice for me, what's interesting is I went to an entrepreneurial academy. I have a specialized high skills major for business. I was a business owner before I actually started working at Scatticore. I had to have my own baking business. Folks will always support a local brand or a smaller business brand that is authentic and true to themselves. A lot of folks try to find ways of saying, like, how do we appeal to this customer? How do we appeal to that customer? And it's like, actually, how do you stay true to yourselves? I think that's the key part. Don't change a brand up for trends. I think, you know, remaining yourself and remaining who you are is the most important in a business and making sure that doesn't get lost. Oh, and I look at all the sales we've made for the Stitch Lab. Like, we were really fortunate to even go to London. And what really sold folks was not necessarily the products, right? The products are great. They look great. But you could find similar products. It was the story. It was the fact that you took women that, you know, were made to feel invisible, were made to feel like they, you know, just were there for just the children, figure out how to live their lives. And they took back a part of their lives that they didn't think they had. It doesn't matter if you're 18 or 60. At the end of the day, I want you to feel like you did something here. Like your own story mattered, your own time mattered. And yeah, being a mother is a great entity because a lot of these women in our collective are mothers, grandmothers. That's a great part of identity. But now it's like you have something to do for yourselves. And I think it was that story about, you know, them saying, you know, I used to sew back home 50 years ago when I used to have my own doll dresses, but I didn't pick it up for 50 years until I started doing it again now. For me, at least, when I'm shopping online, it's like, yeah, this like toe is really cute, or like, yeah, this jacket's really cute, but it's like, whoa, it's made by a digital woman, like who did this because they, you know, they were brave about it and actually did something for themselves. As the proceeds are going back to like X, Y, and Z, that's where I give my money. And especially in a movement now where it's like, we're now looking at like the Me Too movement, you're looking at, you know, like the Indigenous kids movement, you know, you're looking at like so many different things that are happening in this country, right? It's like, I'm gonna shut up and put my money where my mouth is. And for me, it's important to support those folks who are going out there and being brave and saying, hey, it's going back to the Fire Council for Toronto, or it's going back to Six Nations, or it's going back to, you know, like for like a local program in Toronto to teach women how to sew. That's what's important to me. So I think if you're starting up a social enterprise, think about what your impact is. Think about what your story is. Those are the things to me that matter the most. Your products can always upgrade, elevate, change, but who you are shouldn't.
All right, now what? The Abundance Store in Nova Scotia, Farmgate Crate in British Columbia, Home Care Cooperative Development in Ontario, Next Inc. Women Energy Auditors in New Brunswick. All of these are Investment Readiness Program investees of the Canadian Women's Foundation. Learn more about them and what we can do to boost social purpose initiatives of women and gender diverse people by visiting our website, CanadianWomen.org. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless. In these rocky economic times, affordable, sustainable food feels elusive. Can you do food business in a way that does good? And how are women and equity-seeking people leading the way? I'm Andrea Gunraj at the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What? A podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Let's back up a bit. We talked about this last episode. Lots of women and equity-seeking people get into entrepreneurship. The number's only growing. It makes sense. Those who face barriers to stable employment, like no access to childcare or elder care, and those who deal with a lot of discrimination and harassment at work have to get creative. They often get entrepreneurial. They have dreams of not only running their own businesses, but doing good in the world while they do it. The trouble is that these same entrepreneurs also face barriers to growing and financing their businesses. That's why our investment readiness program is so special. It helps business enterprises that do good in the world, run by and for women and gender diverse people, get investment ready. But what does it mean to get investment ready? Well, it's all on the scale. Some of these social purpose enterprises are still in the concept stage. They're product testing, planning, piloting. Some businesses are in a launch or growth stage. They want to scale up and expand. They want to start taking on investments. This brings us to Brianne Miller, one of the women behind NADA in Vancouver, British Columbia. NADA is one of our investment readiness program investees that's up and running and doing its thing. With mounting food insecurity and environmental degradation in food industries, NADA's a fantastic grocery business to learn about. It operates on a package-free food supply chain devoid of excess and waste. It's a way to grocery shop with a commitment to healthy people and a healthy planet.
A little bit about me. My background is actually as a marine biologist. I worked for almost a decade studying everything from coral reefs to tropical fish and marine mammals, and was really lucky to live and work and travel in a lot of incredibly remote places around the world. And I got to work in some really cool field sites, meet a lot of really phenomenal people. But ultimately, it really did open my eyes to the impact that our industrial food system was having going on the health of our ocean. So I was able to work in a lot of field sites that were really hard to access, you know, several hours by boat or many hours down a logging road. It was just incredible to see the amount of plastic pollution that was in a lot of these otherwise pristine and incredibly remote places. What was most eye-opening for me in the very beginning was that I was seeing a lot of items and brands that I was using in my everyday life. So things like toothpaste tubes and shampoo and conditioner bottles and flip-flops and, you know, a lot of normal everyday things. And that was just kind of the wake-up call that I needed to change. That really started me down this journey of trying to reduce my material consumption of things and to reduce my own personal carbon footprint. And a big part of that was reducing both food and packaging waste. It was really tricky to do with food. Replacing things like furniture secondhand, shopping in consignment or thrift stores was a bit easier to do for clothing. But when I kind of got to the food category, it was really tricky to do. There weren't a lot of options. A lot of entrepreneurs wanted to set out and try and solve a problem that I was facing myself. Yeah, so that was kind of the start of Nada. It's been really fascinating over the last couple years to really learn just how much more of an impact than what I had initially thought the food system is having on the oceans. Everything from fishing and bycatch to ocean noise and industrial agriculture that creates dead zones. Like, there really is a lot of overlap between our food choices and the downstream impacts. I'm a very adventurous person. Like, I love to be outside. I think that's where a lot of my work in conservation stem from, is the idea of being in these magical places and falling in love with the environment. And I think when you're in a space and can really appreciate it, you know, be it the ocean or a forest or on the top of a mountain. I moved out to BC for a summer when I was 18 during my first year of university to live with one of my friends who moved out here just for a couple months to live with her aunt and uncle. I had a job in Ontario at the time and my parents wanted me to have a job when I moved out to BC. And so in the span of a week, I quit a job in Ontario, got a plane ticket, moved to BC, and I got hired at the grocery store in a little town called Pemberton to work in the grocery store. The funny story is that I absolutely hated it. I worked there for 3 days and I was in a produce cooler. I just froze my butt off. It was so cold and miserable, and I quit after 3 days. So it's kind of ironic to fast forward a couple of years later and I ended up starting a grocery company.
The term supply chain wasn't very common a few years back, and now I say it all the time, even though I hardly get what the term means, and I know little of the human beings behind it. I'm intrigued by what you say about food supply chains and your business, so tell us more. What does Nada do, how do you do it, and who is a part of it?
You definitely make a really good point, and that is truly at the heart of what we're trying to do, is bring some transparency to these supply chain conversations and to really connect people to their food so that they understand where it's coming from and how it's grown and, you know, what happens if it doesn't get eaten. There's a lot of steps in the food supply chains that are often hidden from view. We really are on a mission to connect people to their food. We do that by building a really community-based, localized, and circular food system. What we do is source very responsibly grown, made, manufactured products. We work with a lot of local companies. That's a really big focus for us because there are a lot of advantages to localizing our supply chain, especially from a carbon footprint perspective. For us, we really love working with local companies. It makes what we do a lot easier in terms of distribution and the logistics of delivery, transporting goods over a shorter distance. That really has an impact on both the quality and taste of food, which is obviously super important, and what a lot of people come to us because the food is just good and everything else is kind of like this added bonus. What we're doing is allowing people to buy groceries package-free. It's this whole idea of like, how can we redesign our food system to be circular in nature? We got started with a retail store. So in the early days, we set up shop in Patagonia. I did not know anyone there at the time. I just cold called them, had this crazy idea and said, hey, can I set up this little like package-free market in your store? They were totally on board and we had more than 100 people come to the first pop-up shop. We had a lot of interest and just started to learn right from the very beginning about where people were coming from and what products they wanted to see and what containers they were bringing and how they were getting to us. There was a lot of information that fed into the design of the store. By the time that we opened, we actually had thousands of customers who were ready to shop with us. So it was a really good strategy. We learned a lot along the way. And then things changed really quickly with the pandemic. We pivoted online. We did have to close at the beginning for a little while because we were impacted by some health regulations that prevented the sale of bulk foods. I'm sure you remember most other grocery stores, you would walk in and the bulk bins were either taped or saran wrapped up. But for us, that was our entire business model. So we had to pivot pretty quickly and figure out how to fulfill orders ourselves and turned our retail store into a warehouse and built a website and got online in a matter of weeks. Lots of ups and downs in the last 2 years, for sure. A lot of hard work. And we've basically built an entirely new business model. But it's been really great to start to do what we do at a little bit of a larger scale. We have a new warehouse, and that's allowing us to deliver to 10 cities outside of Vancouver as well. And we're looking forward to continuing to grow.
As a social enterprise doing good and doing food, not as pretty inspiring. Why is this social purpose approach so important to you?
The idea of social impact has really been baked into what we do from the very beginning. And so we have a really holistic approach to everything that we do, and that encompasses this idea of balancing people, planet, and profit together. So we really do think that those three things go hand in hand. A big part of how we've actually structured our social impact falls within the B Corporation movement. So we've been a certified B Corporation from day one, and then we're also 1% for the planet partner as well, which means that we donate 1% of top line revenue to grassroots environmental and conservation organizations. It's been really neat as an entrepreneur to see the power that business can play in supporting especially grassroots organizations in this space. We've been able to donate much more through NADA than what I ever would have been able to do myself. And we've been able to educate and bring a lot of people on or into that movement. Our people are really at the heart of what we do. And so the idea of social impact lies really closely with everything that we do to try to take care of our team as well. Retail and grocery is notorious for being very underpaid and very overworked and very complex. And we saw that with the pandemic, a lot of frontline workers, you know, not being taken care of. So that's something that we really try to turn on its head. We've been really proactive with things like developing benefits programs, and we've been able to pay living wages to all of our team members since the beginning of last year. Really focused on providing really good jobs to people that are looking for some stability and long-term employment. Healthy people equal healthy planet. People are taken well care of if we all have the time to rest, if we can all eat healthy food. People tend to take better care of the environment and have the actual capacity to think about decisions that might involve sustainability and action on that front.
I'd like to pause here. Brianne made me remember something that happened a long time ago. A news story came out about a famous person hunting endangered animals. Pictures of them posting with dead lions sparked huge debates. Everyone had something to get passionate about, and I was upset too. I told my friend that I was mad that the public seems to care more about animals than they care about, say, women getting killed by abusive partners. I told her that I can only really care about people. She said something I'll never forget. Andrea, I get what you mean. But you can care about environmental justice and gender justice and racial justice all at once. They're all justice. They all need each other. Try not to pull them apart. Decolonize your mind. Brianne reminds me that when people are well taken care of, when they are loved and valued and respected, it gives them the energy to do good for the benefit of others and the planet. The cycle of good is mutually reinforcing. This is what we need. This is all justice.
A big part of our impact really does have to do with the way that we source. We got started with this idea of being package free and circular, and that's what really empowers people to come to us because they're super excited to make a tangible action where they can make a swap and see that impact right away. And that has a really awesome ripple effect. But what we then do is turn around and educate them about the importance of their food and where it's coming from and the ingredients and who grows it and how diverse of a supply chain we have and why that's so important. It's kind of that hook that gets people excited. But then the impact side for us is bringing people into this movement of just a different food future, one that is sustainable, circular, regenerative, one that's really diverse, and one that supports people throughout the supply chain in a different way than what we've done.
What advice would you give to someone starting a social enterprise, especially someone who's facing barriers to getting started? And what do you wish you knew when you started?
There too. I would say the first one is to always ask for help. And the second one is to make sure to take care of yourself if you want to be doing what you're doing for a very long time. I think a lot of entrepreneurs, when we get started, we're often scared to share the idea in the first place. But we really found that when we committed to it and started sharing what we were doing, there were so many people that wanted to lean in and help, you know, especially impact entrepreneurs and women-led companies the ideas are inherently very impactful, and there's an incredible amount of people that are willing to step in to offer their advice. I did not have a business background. I did not have a grocery background. I'd worked a bit in the food space before, but grocery is really logistically complex, and you know, it's not a business that many people want to get into, but we were incredibly well supported through a lot of mentors that we were able to connect with. That just had a ripple effect from there with introductions that were able to come. I think when people really resonate with an idea, especially if it can have a big social or environmental impact, that help does tend to come. So I think just making sure to voice it, you know, it's a learning journey. No one knows how to build a company right off the bat, especially the first time. And so asking for help when you need it, I think, is a big part. And then yeah, the second bit is this idea of taking care of yourself, which we, I think a lot of us know is easier said than done, but very much trying to understand that if, you know, if you are working 18-hour days and, you know, not taking time for yourself and your friends and your family and connecting and taking time to move and get some exercise and fresh air, that that really is going to diminish your ability to do what you're doing. Yeah, something I wish I would have known from the beginning, because I feel like that's something that's taken me a couple years to figure out.
All right, now what? The Abundance Store in Nova Scotia, Stitch Lab TO in Ontario, Next Inc. Women Energy Auditors in New Brunswick. These businesses are also Investment Readiness Program investees of the Canadian Women's Foundation. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless
support. Hi everyone, I'm Emma Partridge, and I want to welcome you to a new season of All Right, Now What, a podcast by the Canadian Women's Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for our first three seasons, where we explore the pandemic's impact on women and girls. But even when this virus recedes, its impacts will continue to be felt. We still need systemic change to achieve gender equality. So, moving forward, every week our experts will put an intersectional feminist lens on one topic we've all been hearing about. The issues and stories that just seem to keep resurfacing and make you wonder, why is this still happening? How is it possible we haven't fixed this yet? We're going to explore the systemic roots of these issues and real strategies for change. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and the organizations that we support takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations.
Hi, I'm Andrea from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Well, many women and equity-seeking people know what it's like to be told to lean in at work. At the same time I've seen a lot of news stories about the gendered pandemic, I've seen stories about how women can stand up for better treatment at work. This is usually meant as good advice, but especially in the pandemic, I'm not so sure that it's that helpful. I spoke to my colleague about this issue, as well as the work she's doing to change entrepreneurship in Canada so that more people and communities can actually get access to its opportunities and promises.
My name is Sigal Dwelly. I'm the director of the Investment Readiness Program at the Canadian Women's Foundation. And for the past few years, I've been working with charities and nonprofits led by women and non-binary people who are really looking at investment opportunities as another potential option to sustain and grow their enterprise and charities.
In the pandemic, the topic of gender and work has come back to the public in a big way. There are huge trends, but it strikes me that when we live it, we don't often see the trends. We experience it as personal issues, not being able to make ends meet, feeling stressed in our jobs, pressure to stop paid work to handle unpaid responsibilities. For you, what are the main things that we experience individually, but really are about the gendered experience of the labor force, big trends that go far beyond us?
Yes, I think women and marginalized women are feeling burnt out, you know, exhausted, living paycheck to paycheck. We're worried about not having enough money or, you know, basic living expenses. And some women are leaving jobs because of, you know, childcare, family responsibilities. And some are moving into prolonged periods of unemployment or leaving the labor market altogether. And I think these personal experiences have been exacerbated during the pandemic. And we know that economic losses have fallen most heavily on women living on low income or experiencing, you know, intersecting inequalities based on their, you know, race, class, disability, immigration or migration status. And there's no doubt that there are larger gender differences in the labor markets. I mean, women are overrepresented in some of the most hardest hit sectors like frontline staff in food, tourism, and hospitality industries. And the pandemic has really highlighted this need for a structural change when it comes to the gendered experiences, even in the labor force. What's really interesting is that just this year, RBC's economic report, they launched just earlier this year, and they said that 10 times more women left the labor market in the last year, more than men. That's an astoundingly high number. I mean, that's 10 times more. Since last February, nearly 100,000 women, 20 years or older, have left the job market altogether, compared with fewer than 10,000 men who are 20 years or older. So I think, you know, one of the biggest issues is this lack of affordable and accessible childcare. You know, when we think of the labor force, we don't think of childcare, but affordable childcare has become really a massive issue for caretakers in the pandemic. And it's really women who have taken the toll. Many women, you know, didn't have the option to return to work without daycares and childcare centers and schools being fully reopened. And with most schools and childcare centers open now, it's still a huge issue, this issue of inaccessible and unaffordable childcare. I mean, all across Canada, there's been a push to move forward with a national childcare plan to implement a $10 a day childcare. And, you know, as we're seeing the economy slowly recover, it's going to be so vital that we don't take our eye off this big trend. You know, investing in affordable childcare is essentially investing in caretakers, and it's investing in more gender inclusive labor force. I think another thing is that women tend to carry the burden of unpaid work. There's no doubt they're taking care of family responsibilities, you know, of aging parents. Not to say that Canada's aging population issue didn't exist before the pandemic, but women are usually the primary unpaid caretakers. And they've seen a massive increase in the hours of kind of unpaid labor here. In many cases, it's emotionally, physically, and financially challenging for women when they're trying to balance, you know, being a caregiver, accepting aging parents' limitations, or, you know, finding caregiver support. And so I think to a certain extent, when we're talking about economic recovery, we have to talk about common gender barriers that we're experiencing at the personal level that have been really amplified. I think of things like this concept of opting out. I don't really like the term opting out because it seems that most women have a choice. But in reality, it's that some women are being forced out. Of course, many women can't leave a job or need to earn income. And this is especially true for marginalized women who face the highest barriers to employment and are really, you know, overrepresented in low-wage, precarious work. And without specific supports and accommodations, you know, they're the ones that will have the greatest difficulty in accessing jobs in the economic recovery. But there's also many women, you know, that go from full-time work to part-time work, or that are becoming entrepreneurs, or starting flexible kind of side gigs because of, you know, these insurmountable challenges of not having affordable childcare and doing, you know, most of the unpaid house or care work, and also employers just not offering enough flexible work options. Another kind of gender bias, I think, is this impact of the maternal wall. You know, we know that women are more likely to have interrupted working careers due to the caring responsibilities. So they tend to go in and out of the job market during their career. There's lots of evidence about women's, you know, wage penalty per child compared to men, whose, you know, wage increases as a result of having children, or, you know, what's called the motherhood penalty versus the fatherhood bonus. And then, you know, to add to this is this almost like this corporate-like model that we're all kind of familiar with, right? This workplace culture that favors someone who, you know, puts in more hours. It's a model that really isn't designed for people who want to have children, or for women or caretakers who do the bulk of the childcare, who do the bulk of the care work and housework. And so, you know, so having, you know, better family leave policies and really robust reintegration programs after maternity leave and, you know, flexible working conditions are really what's needed. And I think another one is also this pipeline theory. You know, I sometimes get these comments, and I know many women do, well, there's a shortage of qualified women in the pipeline, you know, or women are choosing to go into higher paying industries. And, you know, the obvious sector that comes to mind is trades and science and tech, engineering and math, or STEMs, and where there's a huge underrepresentation of women and non-binary people. Well, it's because the pipeline is intentionally designed, you know, with holes along the way that kind of leaks. And so when girls are told that they're not good at math or science, or when classrooms and schools are not really inclusive, you know, at the college or university level, and when it comes to landing a job, the workplace isn't really conducive to kind of staying in it, then there's, you know, all these leaks along the way in the pipeline. But I think it's also really important to note that we could easily fall back into typical, oh, well, let's help our young girls, because if we don't at the beginning, we're doomed to continue to have less women in trades or STEMs, which, you know, tend to pay higher. But I think with this recovery, research is showing that women and non-binary people are also retraining and upskilling. it kind of addresses what some advocates in STEMs have been doing, you know, simultaneously to fix all these multiple leaks in the pipeline, you know, to find a better solution. And I think programs like the Economic Development Program and the Girls Fund Program at the Canadian Women's Foundation, you know, really doesn't only focus on funding and supporting women and non-binary people in trades at the youth level, but at all stages, you know, in high school, university, at any point of their adult lives, if they're switching careers or entering a trade for the first time. So all this is to say that, yes, gender and work has come back to the spotlight in a really big way. You know, absolutely, some women are pushed out or leaving jobs altogether because of the high demand of taking care of children or kids, you know, having less flexible work options. And with all the, you know, challenges in the economy right now, there's also a rising skills gap, a shortage in certain sectors, and women are also letting go some of their jobs, and some are entering entrepreneurship, right? And so some are also switching gears and careers, or as some say, kind of leaning out or downshifting their careers and leaving the labor force.
I sometimes get asked, how can women do better when it comes to negotiating compensation or asking for more resources in their departments or getting paid time for leading diversity and inclusion efforts at work? I always end up saying that while I have no problem with people sharpening their negotiation skills, I do think the question is misleading. For you, what are better questions to ask, and what are the better answers?
I think there's a deeper reason about, you know, compensation. You know, if you allow one gender generalization, I don't think women are risk averse or unwilling to take risk, which is a trope that I hear so often in the entrepreneurial and investment space. I think women are risk astute. You know, they make more thoughtful, informed decisions. And some women know that negotiating higher salaries just doesn't pan out in their favor. And I think you're right. I think the question is misleading. I think the problem is that it focuses exclusively on women, that women need to do X and Y. They need to work harder, be more strategic. And so this concept of, you know, leaning in that was made mainstream popular a decade or so ago is that women carry the burden of changing. And so there could, you know, be a backlash in that women may be called too assertive, for example, or too aggressive and face a penalty of acting too assertive, which is characterized as some sort of masculine trait. And there's just no proof that leaning in actually makes that much of a difference. And in many cases, women get burnt. And I think the better question to ask is why we're asking women to make these changes. You know, why is the burden on women? Why not ask the rules of the game to change here? You know, why aren't more companies and organizations being open and transparent about disclosing their salaries? For example, you know, Stats Canada research shows that pay transparency reduces the gender wage gap. In Canada, university departments, you know, where some faculty members disclosed their salary, saw a 30% reduction in gender pay relative to departments that didn't disclose. I think when we tend to focus on women needing to change, we ignore kind of the whole system. We're perpetuating many myths of gender equality, you know, and like you said, you know, about being asked what women can do more to get more resources for the department or negotiate higher salaries, it kind of perpetuates this myth. And so, well, when someone asks, well, how can women do better? I think the question, some other questions is to really check if there's also other gendered implicit biases at play here. You know, some of them are, for example, the competency or likability bias, it's called, where women have to like prove themselves, you know, time and time again in a way that men don't really have to. When there's this preference for gendered stereotypes of masculine traits that aren't preferred in women, research shows, for example, if, you know, give a resume for a leadership position, there's a propensity for both men and women to prefer males or male traits. And it's, you know, this idea that we see men as masculine traits as leaders. And, you know, this is perpetuated in media and reinforces all these stereotypes where, you know, men are ambitious and women are difficult. And there's other biases, you know, where we have different gendered standards. It's even more pronounced with people with intersecting identities, you know, racialized and trans people, for example. This has been researched, for example, in the corporate world, in the nonprofit sector, the entrepreneurial space, where men are judged on potential and, you know, women are judged on achievements, or a man's success is attributed to skill. A woman's is, you know, overlooked or attributed to luck. Women's mistakes are remembered, you know, and their successes are quickly forgotten. You know, there's all these, I'm speaking kind of in binary terms, but it's just to kind of reiterate a point that there's these different gendered standards that exist. And I think the impacts of all of these practices are really far reaching, you know, from racism and sexism to women finding less positions in leadership, getting promoted less, having to prove themselves. And so employers can really step up here and address some of these issues. And so I think some of the better answers are already being implemented by organizations and being advocated by experts all across Canada. I mean, when we think of companies and organizations, they can be a lot more transparent in their pay. Organizations can show what other staff are getting paid instead of negotiating. Employers can offer a lot more flexible work. It's a powerful way to advance women because they're the ones who, for the most part, take on the most care and childcare work. You know, flex work is the future of work in many ways. There's also some things employers can do around changing the whole organizational process, not necessarily the behaviors, but the organizational process and design around bias. So, you know, many HR departments are already doing, you know, blind resumes and removing some of those identifying biases. Organizations, not only employers, but government and nonprofit, for-profit, can really take a lot more concrete actions around having more diverse women and non-binary people at all levels in the organization. And I think one example that comes to mind in Canada is an initiative spearheaded by the federal government called the 50-30 Challenge. It's a voluntary pledge where companies, universities, colleges, nonprofits commit to achieving gender parity, so 50%. A lot more significant representation, which the goal is 30% of underrepresented groups, and including Black and racialized people, First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people, people living with disabilities, Two-Spirit and LGBTQI people, so that they can be more represented on kind of senior manager positions or corporate boards. This is a good pathway, but to really make transformational impact, I think research shows that, you know, setting aspirational targets is great, but going beyond that and implementing that into maybe quotas or actions would go even further.
Amongst other things, you focus on the entrepreneurship of a diverse women and equity-seeking people. Why is entrepreneurship such an important focus? Why is it a problem? And what needs to structurally change about it?
It's so important, especially, you know, amongst Black, Indigenous, and people of color in Canada. They're the key economic drivers of recovery, I think, entrepreneurship is in Canada. And so there's so much untapped innovation, expertise, ingenuity that's happening. At the kind of national level, we see the federal government investing $6 billion in a women's entrepreneurship strategy to increase women-owned businesses and access to financing and experts and networks so they can start, you know, their ventures and scale up and access new markets. I think entrepreneurship, you know, at least in my experience in working with organizations, it gives a pathway of personal financial independence. It gives a pathway for freedom and satisfaction for many equity-seeking entrepreneurs. I mean, we see that First Nation, Métis, and Inuit women entrepreneurs are growing at a rate twice the rate of non-Indigenous entrepreneurs in Canada and five times the rate of Canadians that are self-employed. I mean, that's a huge, huge number. Almost a quarter of small and medium-sized businesses owned by, for example, racialized people brought in at least one innovative new production. And that's compared to only, you know, less than 18% of enterprises of that same size. And I think this question about, you know, what's the problem with entrepreneurship, one kind of glaring issue in my mind is just the culture of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurs, especially a venture that's kind of scaling and getting lots of growth, for the most part, are expected to be led by white hetero men. And funders and investors also expect this too. You know, we see fund managers and venture capitalists, you know, pour money into companies run by people in their existing networks, which is, to put it bluntly, usually white men. I think another problem is also just quantifying how much less funding, for example, Black business owners are receiving. It's tough to quantify because the metrics just aren't really tracked in Canada. But entrepreneurs and investors think it's about the same as the US, which is less than 1%. And then in my experience working with Black women entrepreneurs is that many know that their businesses and ventures, for the most part, aren't deemed investable. And it's partly due to a whole bunch of preconceived notions, or to put it bluntly, like historic, you know, racism and misogyny. I think some other problems when entrepreneurs are seeking financing that isn't necessarily talked about as much is entrepreneurs looking at grant funding, you know, funding that doesn't need to be paid back, which is an important source of funding for startups. And recent research from the Network and the Investment Advancement for Black Communities released a report called the Unfunded Report that showed that for every $100 given in grants by Canada's leading foundations, I believe in 2017-18, of the 100, only 30% made it to Black-led organizations. So it's tangential in that it points to an ecosystem problem of not only philanthropic funding, but accessible funding for entrepreneurs, many of whom are enterprising charities and nonprofits that access not only loans, but also grants. to get their ventures going. And I think another problem might sound odd. It's the inaccessibility of language. I think one of the problems with entrepreneurship is how it's defined, because it has a major effect on who gets excluded from accessing programs and kind of wraparound capacity building supports that are there to support entrepreneurs. So for example, an often cited research point is that Canadian women make up 16% of majority-owned small and medium-sized enterprises. But if we add in the definition of self-employed, nearly 40% of self-employed Canadians are women, but they sometimes might not have access to the same programs intended for entrepreneurs because of this narrow and limiting definition. Another problem is just research on women entrepreneurship. It just doesn't consider the intersectional approach, you know, it doesn't consider race and class and status and the other intersecting layers. And what does exist usually just neglects important intersectional distinctions. It's frightening, really, in the last 10, 20, 15, 5 years, that there's so little and almost non-existent data points. You know, Canada just doesn't collect robust, disaggregated race-based information, which makes it, you know, easier to continue to have kind of racist structures in place. I mean, we have, I think, 1.2 million people in Canada who identify as Black, African, Caribbean descent, which is about the same number of entrepreneurs in Canada. Yet there's extremely limited information about Black entrepreneurs, founders, owners, and it just is almost non-existent for racialized and Black women. I'm just using that as an example point. And, you know, but what's hopeful is that in this year alone, you know, recovering this pandemic and the shift in social movements, we've had five separate reports focused exclusively on the state of Black entrepreneurship in Canada. Two of them were focused on racialized and Black women and non-binary people. An organization called Pitch Better, which is run by two young Black women entrepreneurs, launched one of the reports called Founders, which is a interactive kind of dashboard and a summary of the one of the most comprehensive national market studies about Black women entrepreneurship in the private and nonprofit sectors in Canada. You know, much of this research is aligned with the systemic problems in entrepreneurship. You know, there's, you know, the entrenched racism, deeply negative experiences involving financial institutions amongst Indigenous people, people of color, Black people, the inability to access capital. You know, there's the lack of general business support, the lack of network and mentoring connections, you know, that look like those that look like BIPOC entrepreneurs. And I think so when we think of this question about what do we structurally need to change about entrepreneurship, we focus so much on the demand side of entrepreneurship. You know, what can we do to support entrepreneurs' success? But little in the way of looking at the supply side. You know, what are the systemic problems in entrepreneurship that's driving the challenges faced by equity-seeking entrepreneurs? And so there's great information about the structural issues and what needs to change in a report by a lady named Ashley Richard. Ashley Lichard is one of the lead members of a report by the Women's Entrepreneurship Knowledge Hub, or Ice Bear Woman, which is an Anishinaabe name given to the hub by an elder. And Ashley presented, I was listening to a webinar about the national needs analysis of Indigenous women's entrepreneurs. And she said something that really stands out as an example of a systemic challenge that Indigenous women face, and especially women living on reserve who often lack, you know, basic infrastructure. So how can you not address these glaring structural issues when we're speaking about entrepreneurship or the need for more kind of relational approaches and less transactional approaches to entrepreneurship and financing? You know, First Nation and Métis and Innu women are facing these structural issues of not having access to financial institutions in their communities or financing through traditional banks and lenders because they need some sort of collateral. But the Indian Act prevents banks from using property located on the reserve as collateral, which is a massive structural barrier for many Indigenous women entrepreneurs when they're trying to access, you know, funding and capital. You know, these are only a few of the structural challenges that need to be addressed. But, you know, if it's okay, I'd rather take the time to plug another great podcast called The Pow Wow Pitch by Sunshine Tenasco, who speaks with Indigenous entrepreneurs across Canada to share stories and lessons of, you know, creating and building impact and healing and reconciliation through entrepreneurship.
Many people don't know about our investment readiness program. What is it trying to achieve and what problem does it solve?
Yeah, so the investment readiness program is a program that's funded by the federal government, and its aim is to support what we call a social purpose organization. So organizations that have an alignment towards a social impact. They're contributing to solving, you know, today's pressing social, environmental, and cultural challenges across Canada. And the goal of the program is to really help organizations build their own capacity so they can participate in Canada's growing social finance market and help them prepare to access maybe future investment opportunities. When we think of future investment opportunities, one that comes to mind is, for example, this large fund proposed by the government of Canada called the Social Finance Fund. It's $755 million over the next 10 years. And so just backtracking a little bit, the investment readiness program gives you some hints in the title, but it's still very vague, right? People ask, well, what's the investment and ready for what? So as one of the delivery funding partners here at the Canadian Women's Foundation, I kind of think of the funding program about two kinds of people who aren't necessarily in the same room often. One is a charity and one is an investor. We think of charities and fundraisers or donors, or we think of investors and we think of profit and entrepreneurs, but we don't think of charities and investors together for the most part. The program is working with entrepreneurship-minded charities and nonprofits that are really innovating and addressing these issues. We're working also with investors in that they're not only looking for the kind of bottom dollar return or profit, but they want to align their investments with their values. The program is specifically geared to support charities led by or serving women with the goal of boosting their participation in the sector. So for example, charitable organizations that want to start and scale a social enterprise, or they're looking to sustain and grow their revenue generating opportunities. And so often we see charities and nonprofits run businesses to help fund and grow their social impact. And so the investment readiness program really is supporting their journey to become more prepared, either financially or organizationally, to take on some kind of future investment, either from an investor, a bank, or a community investor that has really an aligned mission. And sometimes organizations are looking to kind of to put it in day-to-day aspect is they're looking to maybe investing in market research. They're looking at business planning. Maybe they want to explore a business idea, or maybe they want to look at, you know, how do they measure their impact? What does that mean to them? You know, how do they communicate their story and their mission? And so all of these are ways that charities and nonprofits are kind of looking to better prepare for future investment opportunities. Social finance and investment isn't appropriate for all charities, you know, for every charity. But for some charities, small and large, we're seeing an appetite, demand, and they want to be able to design and govern and access and financing that meets their needs. One of the big aims of the program is to contribute to this more inclusive and diverse, you know, social finance market in Canada. I think the big goal of the program is to, of course, encourage the growth and readiness of women serving organizations, especially women who may not consider themselves as part of this kind of larger ecosystem. So we're prioritizing funding to organizations that reach women who face the most barriers or multiple barriers and in communities where the need's the greatest. I think a second goal also is to promote entrepreneurship of, you know, the growth of small and medium-sized enterprises that helps women kind of develop their own economic prosperity. The more knowledge and experience in the use of social finance tools that they have, the better for the sector, and they're better able to support their own enterprises. And I think the third kind of goal of the program is to influence and raise awareness of the importance of gender inclusivity in the social finance and investment space. I think personally, Michael, working through the investment readiness program is not only the readiness, but awareness, you know, investment awareness. If women and non-binary organizations or people that are usually most excluded from these spaces are not even aware, then awareness is equally as important to accessing funding so they can be better prepared for future investment.
This week is the start of Domestic Violence Awareness Month. 44% of women in Canada report experiencing some kind of psychological, physical, or sexual violence by an intimate partner in their lifetimes. For Indigenous women, women with disabilities, women in the North, and others who experience multiple barriers, the statistics are even worse. In the pandemic, this high risk of gender-based violence has only intensified. I'd like to encourage you to look at the facts about gender-based violence on CanadianWomen.org. This is a very popular page on our website with good reason. It sheds light on this yet taboo issue that we all need to know more about.
Thanks for listening. Just by downloading and sharing the show, you're supporting gender equality. If you'd like to help Canada get even closer to gender justice, consider donating to support our work at canadianwomen.org.
Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM. Ah.